You've just landed inside Launch Street, the innovation podcast, where we interview top innovators out there shaking things up so you can innovate and differentiate and get further faster in this crazy cluttered world. And now, innovation thought leader and your super fly host, Tamara Kleinberg.
What's up, Launch Street? Tamara here, your host and wannabe avocado farmer. So do you ever feel like you are just, you know, going through the motions? Or maybe you look around the office and it feels like everyone else is just, I don't know, showing up to show up? I know we can't be on all the time, but wouldn't it be great to feel energized and at your best at the place where you literally spend most of your life, work? Now, I'm not talking about health and wellness, although that's totally important. We've done that in a different podcast, and I would encourage you to listen to it. What I'm talking about here is your personal leadership potential, the potential that we actually all have inside of us that elevates us. So I got curious about that. So I invited Jason Troy, executive coach who works with executives, entrepreneurs, rising stars to maximize their leadership potential and performance. Pay close attention to our conversation around why we don't really show up for work. And he's got this cool card game called Cards Against Mundanity that actually works to combat that kind of going through the motions thing that we all struggle with. It kind of shakes things up a little bit. Now, Jason is an instinctual risk taker, which means he connects dots. He sees patterns in new and meaningful ways and innovates in that uncomfortable space on the edge. I think you'll hear how he used that to push the envelope in his work, his willingness to say and do uncomfortable things in the spirit of progress. And that's really what it takes, doesn't it? All right, time to leap in and listen. Jason, thank you so much for joining me today.
Hey, well, thanks for having me on the show and speaking to your fantastic tribe.
Thanks. I'm so looking forward to it. So I want to ask, how did you get so passionate about maximizing leadership potential in people?
Well, I love people. So that's one thing. I'm an extrovert. So being around people is something that's always fascinated me in human behavior and how people work. And I think, you know, one of the things is being a leader is people having more accountability. I think in today's world, it's really interesting that there's all these opportunities that we have and things that we do, but accountability in most people slips by the wayside. And I think for a real leader, it's being accountable to finding people's talents, ability, and helping them maximize it. Because then if you're in an organization, you can really go places. And it's more about having a contribution mindset than it is having an individual growth or just focusing on your own betterment.
So I want to back up and talk about accountability for a second, because we're on the phone, you can't see me, but my eyes just lit up because that is one of my biggest requirements of myself, and I would say pet peeve in others, is lack of accountability. So talk to me a little bit about why that is so important and out of the gate and why that matters so much. Because, and actually, I want to ask how it slips by the wayside so easily, because you're right. And in so many people, it seems to be missing, yet it's so integral.
Yeah, well, I think the part of it is that accountability requires you to show up even when you don't want to, and actually take action and move into a lot more uncertainty, be a lot more curious, and then own the outcomes. Rather than just being responsible for something, it's just, yeah, you know, I've got to do this, right? But there isn't another higher level beyond that. So it's like a low level, bottom level part of accountability. And I think when you're not accountable in your own life, you just get stuck. You stop caring. You stop looking for the real answers. It's just like conversations. I'll have clients come to me and they'll be like, you know, I don't trust that person. It comes down to that. And I ask, well, what about it you don't trust? And they sit there and they struggle with what the answer is. And I said, well, you being a leader, a manager, part of a company, like, you got to be accountable for that. I mean, telling someone you don't trust them or feeling like that just alienates you from someone else and puts you in a position where you don't have to take any action. When you actually say, I don't trust someone because they don't respect my boundaries, they don't show up on time, they don't care about their work, right? They tell secrets to other people. Well, then you can address that person, solve the problem, and move forward. But you can't if you're just responsible for what's going on around you, because you're not going to take that extra action. And then you can move that over into your personal life, right? And that's why people, marriages, if you take a look at the numbers, second marriage divorce rate is higher than first, third is higher than second, fourth is higher, fifth is higher, sixth is higher. It basically goes on, I think, until the seventh or eighth, where it actually plateaus when the rates are like in the 80s or something like that high, where it almost can't get any higher, or it doesn't even matter if it does. So it's just something that we don't really teach people and require them to do that. And I think leaders do a really poor job of that as well, right? Another example would be, you know, most leaders don't sit there. I mean, even CEOs in big companies or C-level people, and think about, well, how am I going to develop the talent on my team? Like, what are these people going to do if they leave here tomorrow? Like, how am I investing in them? I mean, they really rarely don't. Even people I find that really care. Like, I have great clients and people I think are and I say that a lot, most of the time, they're not even thinking about that. They're thinking about all the other issues, but really that's a huge performance issue, because once someone doesn't feel like their future is in a good place, they tend to opt out and their productivity drops significantly in an organization. I don't care if you're at Microsoft or you're in a one-man shop. That's what happens to people.
So a couple questions in there, because this is so good and rich with insights. One is, you know, you talked a little bit about, you know, people feeling like when they don't feel like their future is good or they can contribute or have control of it, that they tend to opt out. What about that is something that I, as that person, am accountable and responsible for? And what about that is leadership's responsibility?
Well, I think what, you know, what I find from people is that if you are sitting in a particular role, and you feel like you know what that next step is with, you know, some certainty level, then you're pretty locked in. But if you start to wonder what that next step really is, you tend to flounder and you're not really in your personal zone and you're not going to be operating at your highest level. So your job as a person is to ask your manager, maybe your manager's manager, people around you for feedback and how you can improve, you know, ideas they might have. I think you can get out and get some, you know, coaching, get some other help, get some support. I think there's a lot of things that you can do. I think the challenge comes in people don't know what to do, because we don't teach them at any level about how to go about this process of really improving your own taking your own self-development in your own hands and figuring out how do you achieve mastery in your own life, right? So I'd say that's one, right? On the other side, for a manager, you've got to be saying to yourself, okay, I've got a person or people on my team, like what path do I put them on so they can continually grow, both in sort of the soft skills area, right, and a lot of the other places, and some of it may be domain expertise. And like, do I pay for them to go get a coach, to go do conferences? Am I sitting down talking about the next steps that they can go in this company, outside of this company? Are they really happy? I think that's a requirement for a leader, right? If you want to be just a manager, then you don't really care about that. But if you want to be a transformative person and you want to rise to the highest levels, that's a requirement for you to do that, because that's accountability in taking charge of the people that you manage. Now, the people underneath you have to do the work too, right? I mean, it's a two-way street.
So this is so fascinating to me, because first of all, I just came from a session with my business coach, which I have and have had for a long time, and I have multiple actually. And it's, to me, is just critical to my own growth as a business owner. And I think that this conversation really applies to whether you are, you know, a leader in a company or you own your own business, because frankly, even as an entrepreneur, you need to be a leader, not a manager. And I think sometimes as entrepreneurs, we tend to be really good at whatever product or service we do, but really bad at building a business. And it's because we're bad leaders at the end of the day, among other things. But I think that's a big part. So I'm curious, from your perspective, you know, do you have to have a C-suite title, a leadership role, to invest in yourself and spend the time to maximize your potential? And if you do, why? And if not, what do you do about it at all the different levels, and or entrepreneur, intrapreneur?
Yeah, I mean, you have to invest in yourself continuously, because every time you get to the next level, you have new sets of blind spots and challenges that you'll hit a ceiling and plateau on. So it's a lifelong effort. The way that I look at mastery, after talking to a lot of people, studying what people are doing and seeing the people that are the most successful and fulfilled, because I think they go hand in hand. And I think most people get that mixed up. They look at success as the ultimate, but I look at success and fulfillment. And I don't know how you can really divide that, because you can't be successful without being fulfilled. So the pillars that I look at it is that you have to build systems, knowledge, and tools, right, in best practice areas. And you don't need to reinvent the wheel, because everyone out there has developed something, right? It's kind of like hiring practices. There are people that are experts in that. You don't need to be an expert in hiring, but all you need to do is leverage whatever they're doing and maybe add your secret sauce and customize it to your environment at some point, but it's there. How to run meetings is an art, and I've seen it, and 99.9% of the people do it wrong, and that's why they lose massive amount of productivity, right? So you have to learn those things, and they're out there, and it's not that time consuming to go through them compared to the amount of time that you're wasting in doing that stuff, right? The second one is you need to find mentors and coaches, right? And sometimes it's hard to find mentors. But, you know, I think you can, and sometimes maybe at certain points you can't, but you can find coaches and other people that can help that. And the third one is support, right? Because I think that no one understands being an entrepreneur more than another entrepreneur. And the problem talking to someone who's a non-entrepreneur is you have to give them all the backstory. And after a while, that gets really tiring. You want to just get to the 10% of the point of what's going on, and then get feedback or empathy or whatever it is, right? So I think when you have all three pillars operating, you then can start to make exponential progress before you hit a ceiling and then slow down. Because if you don't, you would incremental progress.
You know, and I'd say what you said is so true and accurate, whoever you are, right? So if you're an entrepreneur, you really need other entrepreneurs. If you're an entrepreneur or leader in a company, you want people who have been in your shoes too. I always laugh because my sister-in-law is an executive at a company. I own my own company. There are some things that we're really good at giving advice to each other, and there are other things where we just don't understand each other. And that's okay. It's just, you know, we don't. So we have other people for those conversations. But you said something I want to ask you more about, which is, you know, uncovering your blind spots, those things that are really holding you back of being a leader at work, no matter what your work is. And I'm curious because I, at least what my experience has been, that I don't see them until they slap me in the face and something's gone wrong. So, and maybe that's me just having my head down, trying to get so much done, but how do you discover those blind spots, and what the hell do you do about them? Because they're so frustrating, aren't they, when you find them?
They are. And part of it is your brain is wired to not let you see that because it's so overwhelming.
Darn,
right?
I mean, that's brain. Our brain.
Yeah. Our darn old brain is still not evolved. Right. So that's a huge piece of it. It's why, you know, I'll have friends and I have other friends where I say the same thing, that I feel like, man, you're like Oprah to your friends, but you can't see anything that's going on in your own life. Right. And I mean, that's really what it comes down to for every single person. So no one can see. Tony Robbins, doing that, he can't see his own blind spots, right? Like, I've seen interviews, he can't.
Yeah.
So the guy's been doing that all his life and been around all these people, he can't see them. And what makes you think you're ever going to figure them out, right? It's impossible to do that. And the challenge about going about when you don't find them is they are the biggest things that are holding you back. And they will give you exponential lift, like 100x when you find them.
Yeah.
I mean, so much so that it's like it's life and like life and business changing. But the problem is the requirement is you have to go through a more difficult process to find them. Because if you don't start to dig deep in through your emotions, the stories, the limiting beliefs, you know, the first time you felt this, you know, maybe a trauma when you were a child, maybe older. And you can do this pretty quick, you'll never uncover exactly what's going on, right? And you'll be attacking the problem from the wrong angle, right? So I did an example is I did sales training for one of my clients. And someone raised their hand and typical, I want to sell more, right? Of course, yeah. I want to be a better manager, leader, whatever. So started asking some questions. And I said, you know, when you're talking about this, tell me about like what emotions are coming up. One of the first things she said was shame. And then as I asked a little bit more questions, I was like, well, what does that make you feel? And she's like, right, I feel not good enough. I don't feel worth enough. And then I got down and asked a question. I said, so when's the first time you felt not good enough, not worth enough? And she said, I got on the phone when I was in high school and talked to my mom. And she said, my voice is so high pitched that you're never going to be successful unless you learn to change your voice and make it deeper.
Oh, man.
And this happened to her grandmother and basically got to the point where she never thought she'd be successful and be married. And even though she got married, this tape played in her head. So when she was on sales phone calls with people or on the phone at all, this kept playing in the back of her head. So I said, you realize that the challenge you're having is not being a better manager and a better leader. It's dealing with this, right? And the way you deal with that is you start sharing your story, because she felt the story of shame, right?
Yeah.
And shame dies when it's you put silence in secrets and you share it with people you trust. So first you share with people you trust, then you start telling other people, and then you're off to the races, right? So I told her to tell every client, every prospect. And then what happens is, you know, when no one wants to be vulnerable, but everyone wants it in someone else to lead with it, right? So when you do it,
yeah,
it opens a magical door. And what happened was within less than 2 weeks, she was crushing it, right? And I talked to her 2 weeks later and like in the top 5% in her company and stays there and never leaves ever. Not one quarter has gone down because clients just, I mean, love her. And they basically does almost no work now too because they don't want to leave because she knows everything about them and they know everything about her. And you buy from people that you love, right? And so that's all she had to do, because then she felt worth enough, right? Then at that point, she didn't feel shame. She felt powerful in her own life, right? And then the behavior changed where she saw the phone as her friend and something that she loved to get on, right? Well, that's all it took. It didn't take someone sitting through and paying for $20,000 worth of sales training and sales leadership for her to do better at all.
Isn't that so fascinating? So I just have to tell you, it's a little bit of a side note, but it relates. I was supposed to go see Brené Brown speak last night. My flight was delayed, so I didn't get in time. But we got
to see her.
Oh, you did? Oh, I'm so jealous.
Every time speak, so yeah.
Yeah, I was supposed to see her last night, but we were allowed to submit questions. And my question was, why is vulnerability so hard for us, yet we seek it in other people? And we love it. And I think your story was just exactly that.
No one wants to share because we feel shame because we don't feel good enough. We're not worth enough.
But we love it when somebody else does it, right?
Right. Because the two tapes in your head running all the time is that I'm not worthy or I'm not good enough or I'm not enough. And then who do I think I am? Sort of imposter syndrome. And when you lead with that and you open yourself up, you're so worried that someone's going to come and confirm that once again and beat you up about it. And you're going to feel bad about it again. That's just because the stories we make up in our head always turn out to be the worst case scenarios, right? That's why we don't actually confront other people and talk about it. We think about the worst case scenarios in our head, right? That person's going to leave us. That person's going to hate us. And really, that's almost never, ever, ever, ever the case, right? All the data and research come to that. And even if you ask people and think about it, it's rarely the outcome that happens in your life is the worst case scenario.
So I want to, since we're kind of deep in the vulnerability conversation, I actually want to connect it to innovation, because I think with innovation and creating a culture where new ideas and people take risks and are willing to kind of share those things that they're thinking about or trying new things, I think that takes some vulnerability as well. So will you talk a little bit about that, how those two connect?
Well, I think that, you know, as I was doing my own research for my TED Talk, one of the things that was really interesting to me is that Google spent several years and spent millions of dollars and got the top researchers in to build the perfect team. They wanted to find out what people would be the perfect team, right? Would they be super smart people? Would they be totally techie people? Would they be people that scored 1600 on their SAT, right? They wanted to get down, and the initial thing they thought was a lot of it was individual qualities, right? Well, they really struggled to figure this out, and it took several years for them to get to the answers of what was really going on. And in fact, the answer will be extremely surprising because it's none of the things that you'd ever think about if you wrote down in a piece of paper. I actually had people do this as like a scenario. I said, I will pay you $1,000. If you can come up, I sat down with my friends at dinner and I said, I will give you $1,000. I'll PayPal you right now if you can come up with the answer or pretty close to it. And like no one was even remotely close to it. Because the number one answer and the only thing across every one of Google's high performing team, like every single one, not one exception, right, is psychological safety. Huh. And psychological safety is feeling safe to share personal information and, in fact, doing it. It's the ability to raise questions, right, and to ask and, you know, entertain controversial ideas inside of a team. And that is how the high greatest teams at Google are built. And that's the essence of vulnerability, right? Yeah. That's the essence of innovation. That's the essence of creating greatness within an organization. Why? Because you're more connected to other people. You're more in touch with them. You have greater empathy. You communicate better. Your conflicts are down. Why? Because these people all like each other. They may not all be friends, but they all like each other. And that's the essence of that, right? And vulnerability allows you then to put forth an idea and not blame other people if it doesn't go right, right? Right? It's accountable. Right. And then you go through it and you do triage and you sit down in a room. And this is what you do is you go through every big event. You say, what went well? What didn't go well? What lessons learned? And how can we implement this back, right? Without blame. It's more of how can we move everything forward? Well, you know, when you're in teams like that, that's what you do. The other teams blame. They don't do this stuff. They focus on themselves because that's just what people do, right? So yeah. The requirement.
And I think that to add to that too, I think if you don't feel safe, you're not going to put your ideas out there because you're afraid of looking stupid, frankly. So, you know.
And most leaders do a horrible job of that, right? Because I'll give you a good example of it. You know, most leaders think that they know what's going on in their organization. And, you know, I've had clients of mine tell me that, and I said, I bet you don't. I said, how much do you want to bet? You want to bet 6 months of coaching in advance that you pay me that, like, I don't need to deliver? If that's the case, I'll push all my chips on the table. And they're like, well, how do you know? And I said, when's the last time you walked around your office and talked to people?
Right. Like, without an agenda.
Without an agenda.
Yeah.
And they're like, we don't. And I'm like, okay, so you think that these people are going to magically walk in your office, open the door and feel safe to tell you something when you have no relationship, you're not showing you're caring, you're not spending any one-on-one time with them, 5 minutes, right? And they look around and then they're completely silent every single time. In fact, I've never met anyone that's done that proactively. And that's the biggest issue of why leaders are so out of touch with what's going on is they don't focus on their real core job. They're out there doing fire drills or whatever it is.
You know, I have to tell you, this is years ago. I used to have a no meetings Friday policy. And that was partially for my own sanity, but partially because Fridays I would, you know, grab a different person and go get coffee for my team or just walk around and chat with people. And it was very funny. And I'm not saying this to pat myself on the back because I don't think I was actually intentional about this. It just kind of naturally happened. But then people couldn't – my boss, who was the president of the company, couldn't figure out why my teams were always so much better performing and more profitable than the other teams. But I actually – looking back, I hadn't really connected the dots. I think it's because we spent so much time figuring out how to trust each other.
Yeah, because here's the thing. The ultimate thing about trust, if you remove all the other pillars, right, the most important pillar is caring. And that's the only one that really cannot be broken on the trust to have trust with people. And when people care with their leaders, the reason they stay up to 3 a.m. in the morning doing work or whatever it might be is not because they want to get ahead. I've talked to people about this and I'm certain of the result. The answer is in every single case, they don't want to disappoint the other person. And that disappointment is way higher than anything else, right? And that's why when you create caring and trust, right, and feeling safe, people will do anything for you because the thought of disappointing you is like going into walking on hot coals. They would never want to do that in their entire life and they won't do it.
Well, and they don't trust your intentions, right? I used to have this colleague, she was at the same level as me, who really had a tough time with teams. And when we started to break down what was going on, it was because they didn't, even if she said all the right things, they didn't trust her intention, even if it was actually good, which was to me is a fascinating dynamic of you've got a leader who really does have good intentions, but the team didn't actually trust her.
Right. And that's the key, right? And that's why people, you know, this is always why, like when you see leaders that are overconfident and that are really successful, I always say the same thing. Eventually they're going to crash and burn. You just watch.
Right.
And they'll go down in flames, right, in a big way. Like I had a conversation with one of my friends who works for Uber, and I said, you all are great, but like this guy's out of control. Like, and then all of a sudden all the stuff happened. Like, it's just a matter of time, right? When ego runs what you're doing, you can't be vulnerable and you can't do this stuff because your certainty that you are right is more important than the team or other people. Because if you were not right anymore, then it throws off everything you've ever done. It throws off your identity. It throws off your blueprint. And then what the hell is going to happen at that point, right? I could be spinning out of control so fast I won't know what to do.
So for launch readers out there listening, I want you to pause and maybe even hit rewind and go back, because what Jason's talking about with trust and vulnerability and caring, they are the basis for creating a culture of innovation where you move past incremental, where you get to those new ideas, where innovation actually thrives, where people are willing to put their best ideas forward. And I truly believe that those people on your team or you, whoever you are,
yep,
have those ideas inside of you. They're all percolating. We come to work every day. We're thinking about this all
yes.
the time. But we're actually, it's not that your people don't have ideas. This is what I find actually. It's that people aren't willing to share those ideas because of everything that Jason here is saying. So I wanna ask you about, and we'll put the link to the TED Talk in the show notes, but you had this great TED Talk. And one of the things you said that really caught my attention is that we don't actually show up for work. Will you talk a little bit about what you mean by that and the story behind it? Because I was intrigued by that.
Right, because one of the things that my TED Talk I found is that, like, really how we develop relationships and connections and friendships and caring, when we go into work, we have this false idea that it needs to be so separate and that we need to do things in this like formulaic way and we can't be ourselves.
Leave your emotions at the door.
Leave your emotions at the door, put all our baggage there, right? And none of that stuff works. Well, what happens is that then we put this facade and mask on and we try to be someone else than who we really are, right? Now, yeah, at work, there are certain things you can't do externally, right? Of course, everyone knows that, but that's just a formality, right? That's a
right.
little bit about who you are. But when we stop doing that, we put our humanity in the back seat and we put our emotions in the back seat, and that's not how we're built as human beings. And then we have all of these conflicts, all of these other issues, and I find that we tend to look at stuff like what's in it for me as a taker, right? Like, and then all things go sideways in an organization, right? The person we are to work, we're caring with other people, we take time to listen to them, we want to hear about their stories, right? We do all this stuff, but at work, we're not, right? We're like, get to the point. Like, you know, if it doesn't work, then you're wrong, right? And we take attitudes and we're jerks with people. We're very short with them. It has to fit in some formulaic thing. We don't think out of the box. We're not willing to collaborate and help someone else because then, God forbid, they do well because then they get promoted. I won't, right? And all of this stuff starts to happen. They don't walk around and ask people, how's your day, right? Or help someone out. And that just, you leave it. So basically you show up to work as this imposter, as this like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. I didn't put that in there in the speech, but that's really what I was thinking, right? I mean, you turn out to be Dr. Jekyll at work. we're basically filled with people like this. And like if people say, well, that's not true, Gallup's been doing a poll and, you know, only 32% of like the U.S. workforce is engaged, right? And that's been going up
so low.
Yeah. And loneliness is its highest rate ever in humanity's history. It's at 40%. 40% of people have report they have no friends.
Wow. Man, oh, that's like, so sad. You know,
yeah. Well, I mean, people have almost no friends at work, too. I mean, it's an epidemic. Like, loneliness, they compare it with now, and this is like they've done research on this, to smoking 15 cigarettes a day. And it's at 40% of the population. It feels like they're lonely. And feels like they're disconnected and they're not a part of what's going on. So every 4 out of every 10 people listening to this podcast are lonely. Whether you believe it or not, it's the research. And it's more deadly than high blood pressure. I mean, like all the rest of this stuff, you can look at all the data, they've looked at it. They're making, it's very scientific now. It's not just some like, oh, you're lonely, it doesn't matter. No, because we're hardwired for it. Just like you need to eat, just like you need to breathe.
Right. We need connection.
They now know scientifically that connection is important as breathing, as eating, as drinking water, right? Everything else. So you have to build organizations like this, and you have to build connection as part of it. Because the other part of it is that we don't have go-to people. I was reading some research, and like back in 1980, the average person said they had 2 to 3 go-to people where they could share like any pieces of information, share, put it all on the table, whatever it might be. They did, I think, a couple years ago, and it's now down to 0 to 1.
So here, 2 questions here. One is, how did we get here? And not to spend a ton of time on history. And then I think a second part about this is, what do we do about it? Because it's so interesting to me, because when I look at creativity, right, and the feeling of contributing and being creative, which is an integral part of being human, is there's a lot of joy in that. But a lot of that is found in our emotional beings, because we're emotional creatures. So how do we get to this place where we're stripping it away, and how do we get it back?
Well, I think part of it is that people are just doing less in groups of people. You know, it's one of those things that, you know, I live in Dallas, and I usually see people, like a lot of the charity events I used to go out, these to sell out a lot quicker, and now it's taking a lot longer for that to happen.
Wow.
I think the essence of social media, people feel like they're connected when they're really not, and have the option to do that. People's social skills are eroding, communication, emotional skill sets compared to what they are, right? And all the data supports all of this, right? We're doing less in groups of people. And that's back in the caveman days, right? I mean, we need that within groups and connections.
Yeah, it's how we're wired.
Happening. It is. We're hardwired for that. And people are doing less of it. So the challenge is, in a work essence, too, is that people now are finding their personal and professional life in the same building. And people who run businesses, whether you're Microsoft or whether you're one man or two man shop with consultants, have to realize that's how people are running their life now. You are responsible for their professional and personal life.
Yeah.
It's not anymore you're just responsible for what happens from, you know, 8 in the morning until 8 at night. You're responsible for 24 hours a day, right? And I think that's an important concept for people to really understand if they want to run a successful business and build one.
Yeah, you know, I mean, as an entrepreneur, this is my life. My work is my life. There's no one list for work and one list for home and one list for personal, you know, one list for professional. Like, it's so intertwined. And I think if you work in a company, it's the same thing. I mean, if you think about how many hours we spend at work or doing work.
Or thinking about work. Right?
Yeah.
Right? It's tremendous. I bet when I talk to people about how many hours, they ask them questions, most people think about work about 20 hours a week outside of work when they're not sleeping.
I mean, it's like all the time, basically, when you're not sleeping.
Yeah,
that's
so
crazy.
If you add 20 hours onto it, most people are probably sitting there working at least somewhere between 70, 90 hours of every single week. Just think about that.
Well, so my challenge to all the Launch Streeters out there then, whether you are in a company or own a company, is, are you really taking the time to build those connections and that collaboration and that bonding in your work? Because it is, as Jason is saying, it is so critical. And I think it adds that layer of creativity and innovation to it that I think brings us a lot of joy as human beings, not just because of what it brings us to the bottom line and the potential for those breakthrough ideas. But I think also, don't you think, Jason, as humans, like, we love to contribute in that creative way.
We love to, right? And I think that it's way easier. I mean, I have questions from people all the time. They're like, oh, well, how do I make my company a better place to work at? Or like, what can I do? And I'm like, and I tell people all the time, you can build Google inside your company for almost no money. Yeah. And I'm like, because you just aren't thinking about it the way that you need to by thinking about the base level and creating connections. That's why during my TED talk, I ran across this research when I was originally doing it, because I didn't have any idea about what I wanted to talk on. And I ran a research and I couldn't find stuff that was compelling. And then I read this research by a professor, Arthur Aaron, and he was doing studies on like how to build friendship between people and like how to do it quickly. And he ran this simple game on people asking each other questions that were more vulnerable as they went through it. And they had 54 grad students, didn't know each other, never saw each other, didn't know anything about each other, went in and sat down and just started playing this game. And after 45 minutes, 30% of the people said that the relationship they just created was closer than the closest relationship in their life. And this was in 1997, pre-social media, pre-really internet. So this is not anytime soon. And they've ran this dozens and dozens of times. And that's where I created the game on it, because it's just, it's about asking questions. And if you do this in a company, the thing about it is that what happens most of the time is it's just happenstance that you ask that particular question or something comes up. But you can do it in a way that is actually controlled, measured, and in a short period of time, and then you're off to the races.
You know, it's so funny. So yesterday, I think I was telling you, I was in New Orleans and I was doing a keynote. And before, I was milling around talking to people. And this guy and I started talking, and somehow we launched into our favorite travel experiences around the globe and some of our most embarrassing travel experiences. And I think maybe I talked to him for 20 minutes. And by the end, I swear I felt like he was like a lifelong friend because of what he had shared. And it was just, it was so kind of just to everything you're saying. It is amazing when you have those deeper conversations. So you created a game around this. So talk about talk about it, because I love the idea of it and I want to understand how it works and what you get out of it.
Yeah. So what it is that it's basically a question and answer game, and you run it in a groups of like 4 to 12 people. And I named it Cards Against Mundanity. And you just, it'll be asking questions like, you know, what was your favorite summer job and why? Right. And then you can ask deeper questions too. And like, tell me, you know, if you had 1 year of your life to pick over, which one would it be and why? Right. And you give people 2 minutes to answer. Right. So, you know, it can only get so deep, but you share a little bit of what goes on in a circle. And I've run it in a couple dozen companies, and I've had some people share things I never thought people would share publicly with people, and they didn't know. Right. And you just go around and around like a few rounds, like 3 rounds of people. And then people end it by sharing, you know, 3 things that they learned about different people publicly. And, you know, then you can do some stuff afterwards, and then the magic kind of happens. But the reason it works is because of empathy, because people misunderstand what empathy is. Empathy is not me going through a similar experience to you. It's going through a similar emotion. So if you tell me a story about you being disappointed, I understand that because I've been disappointed.
Oh.
And I'll want to dig into that more with other people, right? And when you share all – now, also, when you share this, you're going to find people that have had common experiences, which then create another level of bonds, right, within the team. And all you need to do is find 1 or 2 people that you feel like that. And it also, productivity raises, because they've done studies. And if you have a friend at work, your productivity and retention goes up 7 times compared to the average person.
Isn't that incredible?
So works like magic, right? And it's basically – I give you the game. All you got to do is sit down and run it. And it's simple, because the other thing is too, is you'd never run across all these questions unless they just came up and you asked someone or something happened. But why can't a team do it together and share stuff, right? The other part that we talked about early is being vulnerable. Well, once I'm vulnerable with you, I'll then more apt to share things with you proactively. And then you will too. And then by certainty, you will start to form deeper connections. What happens then? You, like your best friends, you resolve conflict better, you communicate better, you care more, you collaborate on another level. I mean, all this stuff goes on that you normally don't do like overnight. And it's just simple. You don't need to spend money. It's, they give it to you for free. So, I mean, there's no reason not to do it. And there's every reason that you're going to gain benefits, because I have no clients. I have one of my clients who ran it, you know, net income went up like 25% the next year.
Wow.
And and they've attributed a lot to doing it, because it spurred on a lot of stuff that they saw happening they didn't see before from other people, right? And these were, you know, it was like a marketing agency. So it's a significant amount on the bottom line. And they had some turnover on some key people at the top even, right? That you'd even think that there's no way that could happen, right? So it's simple.
You know, the kind of part of the theme I'm hearing here, Jason, is we spend so much time investing in the hard skills, right? Sales training, software skills, you know, whatever, right? The skill is.
Yeah.
When really, at the end of the day, if we want to be a leading team and a leader that really builds those teams and drives that growth for ourselves, for our organizations, we got to take a step back and work on that foundation of vulnerability and potential and, you know, connection and all of those things, that without it, none of that other stuff matters.
It doesn't matter. I talked to the CEO of the Startup Institute, one of the former ones that was in Boston. And she said to me, the secret to that program there is not the hard skills, not teaching them coding, not teaching the rest. It's the soft skills. That's like 2/3, she said, of the methodology, because that's what matters. And that's what's going to make a coder, a tech person, a great one, versus someone who's average. Not that they're better coder than someone else, because they won't get along with other people and they'll get ostracized. And they've seen this happen. It's that you have to collaborate and communicate better with people. You have to understand. You have to build consensus. You have to understand how to manage difficult situations. You have to bounce back from, you know, difficult situations, from disappointment, and not do it as an individual, but do it as a team, right? So every level of what's going on right now, if you look at people, I've looked at some creative people. I'm doing another project with one of my clients and building a business on, you know, building a leadership, management, emotional skill sets business to help college seniors and art schools come out, because they're having a horrific time. Depression rates are high and they're being very unsuccessful. It's because they don't understand any of this stuff because they're not teaching in the school. Like, they don't even know what to do with all of the things that are happening around them because they're unprepared and no one's teaching them to do this stuff. So it's the future. And if you don't do it, you are going to live in a life that's going to be really difficult and filled with a lot more valleys than you really want to go through.
So one of the things I wanted to make sure we ask you about before we, you know, have to end is, you know, I think oftentimes we ask our teams, whether that's a team of two or, you know, 5,000, to innovate. And when we're doing that, we're really also asking them to make a behavior change. So how do we overcome that hurdle?
Well, I mean, I think that you need to address people and have a frank conversation about what their actions are doing to you and how it makes you feel, right? And I think you can share stuff like what Brené Brown says, is that, you know, confront someone and say, you know, the story in my head that I'm making up is that because you're really short with me all the time, it's that you don't like working with me. Mm. And that you think like I'm an idiot or something like that. And I just want to talk to you about that. Well, if you say something like, the story in my head I'm making up, you're not putting someone in the defensive. But you've got to lead with it, and you've got to have an honest conversation with people. And sure, you are asking them to make a behavioral change, but then you're also saying that you're part of it too, and you have to be accountable in that. Mm-hmm. So there's probably things that you're going to have to do and modify and change too, right? You may have to approach them in a different way. You may have to listen more. You're going to get feedback. That's not going to be a one-way conversation. So you have to be prepared to do it. See, that's what most people do, is they want to blame other people. Being accountable says that I'm sharing something with you, but I'm 50% right, accountable for this, what's going to come out of this conversation. I have to take action, and I have to be held accountable to that. Because it's not, if someone's not listening to you, I guarantee you it's not just because they're not listening. You are part and parcel of the problem.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's actually true, right? I am making up the story in my head. It may be right. I don't know because I haven't asked.
Exactly. You don't know. It could be. Chances are it's not. Because in 90% of the stories that we make up are because we're in the absence of data, right? I think, like, they've only done research, and I think it's about 10% on average of people make decisions based on data at the highest level, right? So that's even people who think that they're analytical. It's really all emotions and stories and everything, you know, and limiting beliefs that are a part of the other 90%. So, you know, whoever's thinking that they're logical, and the people that tell you are very illogical.
Yeah.
They're leading with emotion. They believe that because that's a defense mechanism. That's how they justify the decisions they're making in their own head. But that's not really the reality when you look at the data and the research on how people actually come to decisions when they ask them and they break it all down.
So where can people go to learn more and to connect with you? And we'll be sure, by the way, to put the TEDx talk in the show notes, the link, as well as the Cards Against Mundanity too. So where would you like people to go to connect with you? So
you can go to my website. It's jasontreu.com. And my last name is spelled a little differently. It's T-R-E-U. So it's jasontreu.com.
So my last question for you is, what's the one thing people would be surprised to learn about you? Could be a, you know, hobby, passion, experience.
You know, I'd probably say a couple things. One, I'm always looking to do something new. So last week I decided I'd never run a half marathon. And so in the spring, I'm going to run one.
I love collecting
fragrances of odd things. I just came across some people years ago that started off on YouTube, and I've been following them. So I'm sort of a mini expert, on that. And I'm a huge wine and champagne aficionado too. I've sort of learned over the years with friends. So, And I'm a big Cowboys fan, Dallas Cowboys. I never miss it. So
I feel like that was like a trifecta of odd things all put together into one.
Yes.
In a good way.
Yeah.
In a good way. Well, I can't believe we are already out of time, but that was incredible. I took so much out of this conversation. I know that our launch treaters will too. So Jason, thank you so much. And I look forward to having you back. Maybe next time we can dig further into the cards and kind of what some of your clients have gotten out of it too, because I'd love to hear that.
Thanks.
And before you go, did you hear Jason's point about how innovation requires you to be fully present, not just showing up? How contributing in a meaningful way actually elevates your engagement? So here's what I want you to think about. And this is kind of what I took away from this trip too. Instead of thinking, how can you get engaged and then be more innovative? I want you to flip it. I want you to focus on unlocking your innovation muscles, because then your engagement will rise naturally. So go unlock your innovation. Get on to gototolaunchstreet.com, gotolaunchstreet.com. Link is in the show notes. And check out all of our blogs and vlogs, other podcasts. They are chock full of innovation ideas, resources, exercises, and more. And when you are fully ready to up your innovation game, access our Innovation On Demand online courses and library. That's going to take you to a whole new place. All right. Tamara out.
Thanks for hanging out with us inside Launch Street. When you're ready to take your game to the next level, join the thousands of others that are upping their innovation edge on gotolaunchstreet.com, the top online education resource and community platform for innovators looking to use innovation to get measurable results. Go to launchstreet.com.